I read a three-sentence summary of this plate tectonic theory and would like to do it again just so that we have in our minds a little bit about where we're going. And I was really pretty proud that I could take the basic concept of the science of geology and turn it into three sentences. And in a second, I'll get it down to about three phrases. The outer surface of the Earth is made up of 8 large and 10 smaller rigid pieces called tectonic plates. These plates move in relation to each other on a layer of rock, which, while appearing rigid, exhibits characteristics of plastic flow over long periods of time. The plates are driven by convection currents in the mantle, which is a layer below the asthenosphere. These convection currents form as a way to transmit heat away from the core. Okay, the Earth's made of plates. The plates move around on this plastic layer. The driving mechanism is convection currents, which remove heat from the center and get it to the surface. That's it. We've talked during the week about models and theories and what the point of those are. And the point of a model or the point of a theory is to explain observed phenomena. Some people have heard this for about the 19th time now, so sorry. But that's the point of a theory. We go out and we do some observations, we see things, we come back, we make up a theory and say, well, this is what we think is going on. We go out and we make some more observations and they all seem to fit the theory, so we like the theory better, or they don't fit the theory, so we need to change the theory. Then once we get a theory we like, we can use it to predict what might happen in other places we can't get to very easily, or make predictions for use in like our business lives. Stuff that I do in my professional career is based on these concepts, and we have to have some relative confidence that it's true, otherwise I'm going to get in trouble somewhere down the road. So that's the point of the theory. And the better the theory matches what we see, the more we like it. So what is it about plate tectonics that's so comprehensive? It sort of explains everything. Or what are the things that it explains? It explains where we find volcanoes and where we find earthquakes. When you look down on the globe and you look where the volcanoes are, plate tectonics has an explanation for that. When you look at where the earthquakes are, both in map view and how they change with, or where the deeper earthquakes are in comparison to the shallower earthquakes, it talks about that as well. It talks about where mountain ranges are. That's one of the big, you'd think, with geology, you'd want to know where the mountains are and how they got there, and the theory explains that fairly well. The last thing I talked about yesterday was, I said something about faunal assemblages, where we find creatures. And one of the things that plate tectonics does, the key point to that is it helps explain where we find things in the rock record. One of the lines of evidence has to do with where we find fossils in relation to each other. And so it's not necessarily where we find life today and the distribution of it, but how that, what that distribution was like in the past. We talked yesterday for a little bit about the sort of the state of the science of geology in 1912, which was when this continental drift theory was first ventured or tossed out to the public. And the continental drift over time, the terminology of it changed to being plate tectonics. So we talked a little bit about the geology of the time. There's no point in going back through that. Most of those ideas have been sort of discarded since then. And we talked about the initial presentation of this continental drift idea. The first time it was put into public was in 1912 by a German named Alfred Wegener. He was a meteorologist by training rather than a geologist. He was unsatisfied with the theories that had been presented up to that point. He didn't find them very compelling about explaining things and came up with his own idea. And the thesis of that, the crux of it, was that there was a huge continent made, that all of the land on the planet at one point was joined together in what he called Pangaea, which is Greek for all land. And then at some point that had split apart and the continents had drifted apart to the locations we find them today. He used various lines of evidence to come up with this idea or to start to convince himself that it was true. The sort of easiest to get across is matching up the coastlines of South America and Africa. And if you cut continents out of a map like I did and try and put them together, the fit isn't real bad. And from there, building outward into trying to fit other things together, and North America kind of sits up here. But that was the first thing that he said triggered his mind into looking at this idea. And then another thing that he did was look at those faunal assemblages that we talked about. And those are relatively common, that you find the same stuff here that you find here. And if these things are like this, that's hard to explain. It's easier to explain if they're together. And there were certain rock types that he would find as stripes, that you find them here, and then you find them here. And that's, again, really hard to do if these are 2,000 miles apart. His analogy was if somebody ripped a piece of newspaper in half and put them like this, didn't it make more sense to have them together so that the lines of print would match up? And if in fact they did that, it was a reasonably compelling argument that maybe at one point previously these things were joined. If you had half a sentence here and the other half over here, maybe it made sense that they were together at one point. The initial reaction to the hypothesis was sort of mixed. Some people thought he was onto something. Some people thought he was nuts. Some people were nice about him being nuts, and other people were mean about him being nuts. He died in 1930, and at that point, there was really nobody to push the issue forward or push his idea of the issue forward, and the idea sort of went into discard at that point. And at that point yesterday, we kind of left the soap opera and went back to talking about science a little bit and onto this idea of rock magnetism. As I said before, the Earth has a magnetic field around it. In the early 1900s, there were studies done on lava. People started to do these magnetic studies on lavas because we had the equipment to be able to do that. And they found that for the most recent lavas, the youngest lavas, all of the magnetic crystals or materials in the lavas pointed north, like a compass needle does today. The way I think about the magnetic field is I imagine a huge magnet up at the North Pole, so that wherever you are on the planet, your compass needle points north. For the most recent lavas, all the compass needles pointed north. For the next sort of oldest set of lavas, from a few million years old to about 65 million years old, the compass needle either pointed due north or it pointed due south. And they sort of said, well, we don't get that, but that's a problem, so let's put that up on the shelf for now and do other stuff. And they found that even for even older lavas, the compass needle pointed lots of different directions and really didn't make a lot of sense. This sort of triggered the science of what's called paleomagnetism, paleo meaning old or ancient. And what they found was that if you would go to some place like South America and look for lavas and find one that was, let's say, 100 million years old, the North Pole that it seemed to point to was right there. And if you found one that was a little older, it indicated a North Pole right about there. And the next one that was a little bit older indicated a North Pole to be right about there. And the next one indicated it to be right about there. That's what the data indicate. And once that happens, then you have to sit back and go, what in the world is going on here? Is the machine wrong? Is there something else we're doing wrong? No, that all checks out. Now we have to explain this. And one of the ways that you can sort of check your work here is if at whatever age the North Pole is right here, say 250 million years ago, just throwing numbers out, this isn't true, but just to make an example, if the North Pole is right here 250 million years ago, that means that Brazil is right about where Greenland is today. So whatever rock type or whatever you find up there better indicate that you're in a cold part of the world. If you find a coal seam up here in Brazil, 250 million years old, you should have problems because what your North Pole indicates is that you're relatively close to it. So people started doing this in different parts of the world. This, you know, 1900, communication was reasonably good. Somebody got this good idea, and people said, well, I want to do that too. I need a master's thesis at my school, so I'm going to do paleomagnetism. There are two alternatives. One is that everybody everywhere finds these were called polar wander curves. They connect the dots and say, this over time is what seemed to be the North Pole. And the two alternatives are, if you do this for Brazil and you get this, and you do this for the United States and you get the same thing, and you do it for Africa and you get the same thing, then you have to explain why the North Pole has wandered around over time, which would be, you know, you'd start heading in that direction and trying to figure it out. Another possibility that could crop up would be that if you did this same sort of idea for the United States, you'd get points in a different part of the globe. That the United States rocks indicated that the North Pole should be down here, and the Australian rocks pointed that the North Pole should be over here. And now you've got an entirely different problem of multiple North Poles, which doesn't seem to work out very well with the theory of magnetics. You shouldn't have magnetic fields going, you know, in different directions. And in fact, it's that second case that they found to be true. And so now there was a whole bunch of other head scratching that needed to be done. So they threw that problem back up on the shelf and went back to the first problem that they had about these magnetic reversals and figured, let's study that for a while. We're not getting anywhere with this pile of knots in a string. Let's go pick up the other one and try and unravel some of it. And this was about the early 1950s. And they went back and redid the work and said, sure enough, we got some rocks that point due north, and next to it we've got some rocks that point due south, and went, you know, double-checked the work and tried to come up with other explanations for it, and finally had to say, no, that's the way it works. And while that was happening, other people in other parts of the world were doing the same thing and coming up with the same results. Many lavas younger than about a million years old have compasses that point due north. Anything between about 2.5 million years old and a million years old points due south. At least with this problem, it seemed to be a global problem. It wasn't dependent on where you were studying the rocks. Nobody could come up with, at that time, a real good explanation for why the magnetic field seems to reverse, and nobody still can. So although the mechanism is unclear, it seems to be the case, and it seems to be a global thing. This, and there was a sort of, I don't know how to put it. By doing this magnetic reversal, is what it was called, north thing flipping back and forth from north to south, and by radioactively age dating those rocks, they came up with a time scale to say, okay, from certain periods of time, your rocks were pointing north, your magnets in your rocks were pointing north from 0 to 1 million years ago. From 1 million to 2.5 million years ago, they were pointing south. From 2.5 to 5 million years ago, they were pointing north. From 5 to 8 million years ago, they were pointing south. And so if you were in a new area of studying geology and you did a core on your rock and it said magnets point south, you could figure out which periods of time that might come from. It can only come from one of those periods of time where the compass was pointing south, and then you could use other techniques for trying to figure out exactly which of those periods it was from. So at some point, probably in the early 60s, they had devised a fairly what everybody thought was a fairly precise time record for when each of the little periods of time when the compass pointed north and when it pointed south. That's the magnetic story. That'll come back into play in a minute. The other thing that happened during World War II, and then especially after World War II with the advent of the Cold War, was there was a lot of depth-sounding work done trying to find out what the topography and configuration of the oceans was. Prior to that, prior to 1942 or 43, geology had been done based on the geology of the continents, which is about 30% of the surface area of the planet. We didn't know anything about, we knew a little bit about what was offshore and within 500 feet of probably the surface, so we knew that things dropped off relatively at a low angle in some places, and in some places it dropped off drastically, but as to what was going on in the middle of the oceans, we had no idea. These echo sounding is what it was called. These things were first done in preparation for the amphibious landings during World War II to find out how close the beach came up to the shore where they wanted to land. And then during the Cold War, it became important to map even deeper so that you could find places where you could hide your submarines where the other guys couldn't find them. And this morning I was in here cleaning up from last night and wound up talking to one of the guys who was here last night that said he was on a destroyer during that period of time, and their standing order was at any point that they were going to be on a long straight stretch of sailing that they were to have their echo sounder on so that they could take depth measurements all the way along that trace and report those back. Is every echo sounding, is that foreign to anybody? Does everybody have a basic idea what that's about? Okay. And so whole reams of new data and people who it was important to them that they sort of sort this stuff out so they knew where to hide the subs. And one thing that may not be apparent straight away is that, let's use a different color pen. We didn't send a ship from Boston to sail, I was going to say drive, but that's not right, sail straight across the ocean with its echo sounder on the whole time and move down 10 miles and come back the other way and move down 10 miles. That wasn't the way it worked out. It was wherever you happen to be sailing, turn on your echo sounder, keep a record, and send it back to us. So this thing was really based on little stripes all over the place running different directions, and they all threw it on somebody's desk and said, make something out of this. And it was a couple of folks, I'm not sure where they were at, Bruce Hazen and Marie Tharp at one of the East Coast colleges, and they did all this trace work and came up with one of the first things that they found was that running through the Atlantic Ocean was a mountain range on the bottom of the ocean. A mountain range not quite as high as the Himalayas, but about as high as anything else that's on the surface of the continents. And they found another one of these in the South Pacific. They also found a series of really deep trenches, one along the east coast of Africa, South America, and then pretty much ringing Canada and Alaska and heading over through Japan down to the Philippines, through Papua New Guinea and the Solomons. Very deep trenches. Completely unanticipated by anybody who had been studying geology previous to that. The basic idea was that stuff got washed off the high spots, the continents, and kind of went out into the ocean basins, and that they would be relatively flat at throughout their width. So it was new news, and nobody really knew what to do with it. Along with this echo sounding, they also did gravity surveys to try and determine. Gravity surveys indicate sort of denser rock and less dense rock because gravity is based on the mass of something. And they confirmed the idea that we have drawn up here now, that there are in fact two relatively different kinds of crust out there, continental crust, and it's relatively less dense, and oceanic crust, which is relatively more dense, and then everything is underlain by something that's about the same, and that's what we now call the lithosphere. But that was all new information post-World War II, early 50s through the 50s. One other thing that they found was that there were no sunken continents. One of the ideas that we talked about last night while people were badgering Wegener about this continental drift idea was that there were the old continent of Atlantis set here and had dropped down, and there was a continent that used to sit here so that this area was all really connected so that you could have the same rocks there and you could have the same fossils there. All of this depth sounding stuff and the geophysics stuff indicated that those continents were fictitious. At the same time, some geological sampling was done, and there were two primary things that came out of that. One was that, and it was sort of confirmed by the geophysics, was that wherever you happen to go on the bottom of the ocean, the rock is about the same stuff. It's one kind of rock. It's called basalt. It's a relatively dense rock. We find a little bit of it on the surface. There's some in Oregon. There's some in India. But it's not a real common rock at the surface. So it's different there than it is up here on the continents. And the second thing they found was that they couldn't find any material that was older than 160 million years old. Now, continental rocks range in age from yesterday to 3.6 billion years old, or about 3,600 million years old. And no matter where they sampled, they couldn't find anything in the oceans that wherever they dredged or wherever they dug, they couldn't come up with anything more than about 160 million years old. Everybody said, okay, that's another one of those things that we don't understand that we need to put up on the shelf and scratch our heads about. And so that's about where we left it yesterday, with all of these magnetic reversals that we can't explain, and the seafloor seeming to be something different than the stuff that is on the continents that we've studied so far. What else should be confusing about that? Well, that's enough. In 1962, a geologist by the name of Harry Hess from Princeton University came up with this idea that he called seafloor spreading. Oh, the other thing was, what in the world are these mountains doing out here in the middle of the ocean? That was the third thing that people found troubling.
Can I ask you a question? Why, you know, you said, oh, there's not a sunken continent. Why wouldn't those mountains maybe just indicate those were part of a lower continent?
They would, although they were upraised, although they were higher topographically, higher elevationally, they were made of the same stuff that everything else was.
Oh.
And so, and when we think about the rest of the upraised places on the planet, they're made of generally different rock. So we'd have to make up a third kind of rock other than these two, and it would have some of the properties of both. And, I mean, it's a reasonable hypothesis. It just appeared that although they were mountains, they were mountains built out of the same stuff that was every place else. Okay, Harry Hess came up with this idea that he called seafloor spreading. And what was involved in that was, his thinking was that new oceanic crust was created at these mountain ranges in the middle, and he called them mid-ocean ridges. And that somehow that stuff was brought up out of the ground at these mountain ranges and was pushed outwards and traveled and then went into one of these trenches that they had also found through the echo sounding, and sort of went back down into the mantle from there. Now, what were his lines of evidence? One was this age of the seafloor being so young. If all you have is really young rocks in the seafloor, then you need to somehow be getting rid of them all the time as you go through geologic time, or you should find some old stuff. So how do you get rid of it? Well, you send it back down into the mantle somehow. These things seem to him as a reasonable spot to potentially generate new material, because one of the things about these mid-ocean ridges is there is earthquakes happen along them. They're a focus of earthquakes. And the second thing is there's volcanic activity associated with them. So he said, well, what the heck? Nobody else has got a good idea. Let's go with mine. His concept was that somehow the driving force behind this was that there were convection cells in the mantle. And if you think of a convection cell, I'm going to have another drink first. And what a convection cell is simply that when you boil in a pot of water, it doesn't all boil up towards the surface at once. It boils up towards the surface, cools off, sinks back down as more material is being boiled right here and heating up and coming towards the surface. Same thing happens in another spot in your pot of boiling water. So his thinking was, here are these mid-ocean ridges. Here is the flat part where the crust is being moved outward, because that's the direction of the cell. And then at some point it was being pushed back down under a continent. That was his idea. And what was implied in that was Alfred Wegener's old idea of continental drift. His thinking was that the continents were sitting on this material, and were wherever they were connected to it, they were sort of moving along, sort of along for the ride on top of this oceanic crust that was being generated. And so, really, continental drift wouldn't have been the right word, something like continental rafting, because the continents are sort of bobbing along on these conveyor belts of mantle material that was being generated, or oceanic crust, that was being generated. That was in 1962. In 1963, a couple of English geology, I don't know whether they were students or professors, they were students because they were working on advanced degrees, sort of confirmed this idea of seafloor spreading by taking a magnetometer, something that reads magnetic strength and the direction, and running it over, trailing it behind their boat, running it over one of the ridges. It was the East Pacific Rise, which is this, what I've drawn in down here. And what they found is, as they were, I should do this as a map. If you were looking down through the water as the rocks were laying out on the seabed, here was the crack in the ground where they assumed that the new material was coming from. And what they found on opposite sides of the crack were these, when the compass is pointing north, I'll draw it in blue. When it's pointing south, I'll draw it in white, or nothing, rather. Mm-hmm. And they found these alternating bands going away, and found that they were symmetrical about the crack. And so they said, okay, what this apparently is here's the 0 to 1 million year old lava on either side of the crack, and here is the 1 to 2.5 million year old lava on both sides of the crack, and here is the 2 to 5 million year old lava on both sides of the crack, and it matches up very nicely with Harry Hess's idea of seafloor spreading, that there's material that comes up, the conveyor pushes it out, somewhere it goes back down into the mantle, and Hess's idea works. And I've got a figure about that we'll talk about in a minute. So 1965, a Canadian, Tuzo Wilson, it's appropriate today being, is it Dominion Day today? Is that sort of the birthday of Canada?
Yes.
Not called Dominion Day.
Ooh, sorry. What's it called then?
Canada Day.
Canada Day. The first guy ever to use the word plate is Canadian, Tuzo Wilson. So it's all working out perfect. His conception of things was that all of most of the geology we see, the stuff where something's really going on, these earthquakes and volcanoes, is sort of centralized or sort of restricted to about three different areas. And one was these mid-ocean ridges. The second was the mountain ranges, like the Andes in Peru and or along South America, and the Cascades here and up in Alaska, and coming down through Japan, same thing, near where the trenches are. Or the third thing that he saw was these major faults that were where the motion seemed to be sideways rather than up and down. The best example of that would be the San Andreas Fault. He called these things mobile belts, because that's where the Earth seemed to be mobile. That's where stuff seemed to be happening. And one of the things that he found was every now and again, one of these mobile belts that he was following just sort of quit and picked up someplace else, either in the same form or in a different form. In some places, they changed character from one bit to another, from one of the three types to another. And he called those areas transforms. Something transforms from one of these types to another. And where he had these things that just something was running this way and quit and picked up over here, he sort of connected the two together by what he called a transform fault. Some way that he could explain that they were somehow connected. 3 years later, a guy named Jason Morgan just sort of formalized what everybody had been talking about previously, and he said there were three types of these boundaries to these plates. There were the ocean rises where new crust was generated, there were these trenches where crust was destroyed, and there were these transform faults where crust moved sort of against each other, or side by side to each other, but it didn't create or destroy anything. And the other thing he did was explain that it would work mathematically, that these plates being rigid and flat, reasonably, you wonder how they can move around on a spherical planet like ours, and he sort of provided the math to explain that, and it's complicated enough math that I don't know it, so I'm not going to try and buffalo you that I do. And since then, plate tectonics is sort of the widely accepted basic theory of the science. There's one alternative that's been proposed, and there is a Tasmanian geologist named S.W. Carey and I'm not sure if he's still alive or not, who has been involved all along, and he at the point where everybody else was saying that Wegener was mad, he said, no, he's on to something. But Professor Carey's idea is that rather than Pangaea, this continent, being on one part of the planet and the rest of it being covered up with water, that when Pangaea occurred, it was in fact the entire surface of the planet, and the planet was much smaller at that time. And so what the planet has done since then is expand rather than have these continents move. And his thing is a combination of expansion and torsion, so that looking down from the North Pole, the northern hemisphere has opened up clockwise, and the southern hemisphere has opened up counterclockwise. And all this time, the Earth has been getting bigger. Does everybody sort of conceptually get this idea that it almost opens up and gets bigger as time goes on? I saw Professor Carey in 1986 when he came to the school that I was at, Colorado School of Mines, and he was unbelievably dynamic, and he is very sure that his idea is correct. And he came into a reasonably prestigious university and lectured and taught and pointed fingers and browbeat kind of all the professors and, you know, guys who are fairly well known in geology. And it was kind of fun for the students to, you know, we had a common enemy. And Professor Carey very strongly believes that he's correct. Now, not very many other people believe that. But the treatment of Professor Carey is in some ways real similar to that Wegener got, because Carey is a Tasmanian, and at some point he got thrown out of the Geological Society of Australia for poor behavior or being wacky or whatever. So not many people subscribe to that, but he doesn't need anybody else backing him up. He's already convinced all of them on his own. We had some slides from yesterday. I don't know that they add a lot. If you've got any questions that come off of those, I'll talk to you about it afterwards. We've described, I think the thing to do now, if I can find my handouts, is we said this is a comprehensive theory, so therefore it better explain some things that we see out in the world, and this is the first overhead, or the first graphic that I've given you. And again, the point of the theory is it better describe what we see, better describe the phenomena that we observe. And if you look at the distribution of earthquakes where they seem to be on the globe, and then you look at the bottom of the page and see that those happen along the trenches or the, you know, trenches along the western half of South America or along the San Andreas Fault, that's obviously where the geology is happening. Now, there are two kinds of crust, oceanic and continental. So there are only three combinations that can be together at any one place in time: oceanic crust and oceanic crust, continental crust and continental crust, or oceanic crust and continental crust, right? Those are the only three possibilities. The other thing is the senses of motion that are possible are towards each other, away from each other, or sliding past each other. So that's the genesis of this thing that I made up, your next handout. And I made this up on the boat coming up on Saturday. And, you know, I've studied geology for quite a while and have a bunch of textbooks, and I've never seen it presented this way before. And I don't understand why that is, because to me it makes just perfect sense. So if you see it if I see it in a few years in a geologic textbook, I'm going to know it's one of you guys that ratted me out, and I'm going to come looking for credit anyway, if not cash. So that means that there are only sort of 9 possibilities, 3 times 3, for things out there in geology. And so that if you have oceanic crusts on 2 plates and they're heading towards each other, we call that an island. What I've done is say, here's the general thing that we call it, and here's an example. So if it's oceanic crust on both sides and it's convergent coming towards each other, what happens is one plate will bend under the other, and you have what's called an island arc. In Japan is one, and the Philippines is one, and the Aleutians is one. What did I call that? An island arc. When you look at the shape of this, it's hard for me to do. That's an arc shape. When you look at these Kuril Islands coming off of Russia, it's an arc shape. When you look at Japan, it's an arc shape. When you look at the Philippines, it's an arc that's bent a little bit. And that has to do when you project a flat line, a rigid plate going down back up to the surface, it becomes curved by the way you look at it at the surface. So that's an island arc. Where you have oceanic crust and oceanic crust, and they're going apart from each other, that's called a mid-ocean ridge. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the East Pacific Rise are the two best examples of that. When they're going past each other, there are these transform faults. One of the things that Wilson originally proposed was these transform faults. And so when you actually look at the East Pacific Rise, it's not this thing that goes for 15,000 miles in a straight line. It's actually these little sections of 10, 15, 20, 30, 100 miles, and then a transform fault will offset it a little bit, and then it'll go off, and then another transform fault will set it off a little bit. But it's relatively, I mean, to the scale of the map that we can show, it's a straight line. If you have continental crust on both plates and if they're heading towards each other, that's a continental collision, and the best and probably only example of that is the Himalayan mountains. If you have continents on both sides of the plate and they are rifting apart, that's called continental rifting, and the breakup of Pangaea 200 million years ago, and currently the eastern portion of Africa, that's happening there. The third alternative is that these two continental plates are sliding past each other, and that's the San Andreas Fault. If you have oceanic crust and continental crust on the other side and they're converging, the oceanic crust will generally dive under the continental crust, and we call that a subduction zone. The west side of South America is probably the best example. And I talked to Rick Dunning and Dan, who both are, Rick's a practicing geologist, Dan had his undergraduate in that, and we tried to come up with examples of either of these other two cases, and we can't. So it's not that there's really nine cases, there's really about seven. Transform faults of oceanic crust against oceanic crust are really boring. There's not much going on there. It happens out in the middle of the ocean, so if there's a magnitude 2 earthquake out there, nobody feels it, so nobody cares. It happens a lot, but there's really no great geologic interest to those transform faults. So we'll talk any more about that. Strike slip faulting along the San Andreas causes big earthquakes. It doesn't cause volcanoes because there's no slab being subducted. There's no material going down into the earth and becoming remobilized. So you have earthquakes but no volcanoes there. The sense of motion on the fault is such that everything on the west side of the fault is moving north relative to everything on the east side of the fault. So that in geologic time, Los Angeles and San Francisco will be sister cities, and Los Angeles in time will head off north of San Francisco. Yes?
Is the San Andreas fault case on the transform, that's visible, like if you look down, it's visible. What about, can you see any visibility vertically, like up thrust? So like, because I grew up in Silicon Valley, and you go through these mountains, you know, with a dynamic, and you see the earth like this, like this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the same as up thrust, or is that something different?
I don't think of the San Andreas as having a lot of vertical displacement on it. Minor amounts, but not. I mean, the Sierra Nevada mountains are an upthrust on the one side, and so there's a huge amount of relief there from the high mountains down to the plain, down to the valley there. So that's a different thing. The San Andreas, I mean, the lateral offset on the San Andreas is hundreds of miles. I think anything there, 100 feet of vertical relief there, yeah, probably. Is there a mile? No, probably not. It's much more in the, you know, horizontal direction than it is vertical. There's something else I was going to say about San Andreas? No. So that leaves us about five things to look at. And I have slides for overheads for a couple of those. And this is a figure what's proposed to happen at a mid-ocean bridge. And I'll let you read the text on that at your convenience, but there are three things I want to talk about. One is this material that you find relatively close to the surface is called pillow basalt or pillow lava. It's a very unmistakable sort of shape, and it comes as hot molten material sort of blubbed out into the cold water, and it forms things that look like deformed bowling balls or what they call pillows. And it's distinctive. That's the word I was trying to struggle for before. And this is the only way that they are formed. So one of the things is if you are hiking in the mountains near Hold Village and you come across a bunch of these things, the thing that you should think about is at some point a long time ago, that material was down at the bottom of the ocean, and I've got to come up with some geologic idea to get it up here, because this is the only place that was formed. And it's just a basic geologic concept that certain rocks form in certain places. The fact that you find them someplace else where they shouldn't have formed, you need to come up with an idea as to how they got there. The second thing is these convection cells that are theorized and are generated to get cool seawater help through fractures and through these pillow basalts. When they come out, they don't come out like right tight next to each other, so there's spaces between them. And water gets trapped into those and finds pathways to get through it and gets heated because it's hotter down here than it is at the surface. And more of these convection cells develop, and they form things called black smokers. And I just want to throw that out for now because we're going to talk about those tomorrow. And the third thing is, and I don't see this explained very well in any of the basic geology textbooks, is it shows here that you inject new magma here and it pushes things outward. Now when you think about that, you're pushing something that's liquid up and pushing things that are solid outward. Now that doesn't work very well with my sense of physics. The way I think it happens, and I don't see it explained very well very often, is that probably what happens is you have this solid material and the convection cell down here is pulling it sideways, and you open up a crack, and then this liquid material fills in the crack. And then the convection cell pulls again, and you open up the crack some more, and the liquid fills the crack. I think that's what's going on, rather than somehow trying to get molten lava with the consistency of hot maple syrup pushing rocks apart. That just doesn't make it very well for me. So those are the things about this mid-ocean ridge. So we're blowing through our remaining possibilities of the way things, continental versus, we're going to talk about continental or oceanic, diving under oceanic crust. And the process of the plate diving under the other plate is called subduction. And so here, and it shows on the corner of your picture a globe as to where this occurs down in the South Pacific. But what happens is the Pacific plate, being created at the East Pacific Rise and being pulled by the convection cell going this way, runs into something that's a little bit harder than it and becomes subducted. About the point where that happens, the leading edge of the top plate, and then there's the bottom plate goes underneath it. That, to me, this is a snow plow, and the road's sort of traveling under the snow plow. So what gets caught up on the plow is a bunch of guck that was on top of the snow. That's a picture that I have in my head. So if you're in that part of the world, these islands that form, if you pile up enough stuff, it comes above the water, now you got an island. And you can make a resort there. This material that you find in those islands should be sedimentary rock. It should be the guck that got scraped off the top of the plate as it was going down. So it should be material or rock that's made out of sediments from on top of the plate. As the plate gets subducted, temperature gets hotter as you go down towards the center of the Earth. First, water gets generated, gets heated off as steam, and mobilizes the overlying material, turns into lava or magma, and comes up through this piece of the oceanic crust. The plate continues to be subducted, and at some point below 600 kilometers, something like that, it turns into plastic, and therefore you don't see any more earthquakes below that. That's what happens when oceanic crust hits oceanic crust. Where oceanic crust hits continental crust, you get the other half of the picture. Same idea. Plate gets subducted, you get more, the water gets driven off, mixes with the overlying rock, intrudes the rock material that's already there, you get volcanoes. A couple of things. In comparison of the two, in this case, this water that gets driven off and mixes with magma above it, or mixes with solid rock and melts it and becomes magma, as it goes up, it goes through continental crust. On the first one we talked about, that stuff comes up through oceanic crust. They're different compositions, and therefore, the mountains that you find in Chile are a little bit different than the mountains you find in Indonesia, wherever that the first picture is from. It's made out of a little bit different stuff. It's sort of the same, but it's not exactly the same. The other thing about this is this water that gets driven off, we can identify as being essentially seawater. So it gets carried down on the plate, or as part of the plate, and boils off and shows back up. Seawater has a different chemical composition, and its isotopic signature, particularly of nitrogen, is a little bit different in seawater than it is in river water. And yet the stuff that comes out of these volcanoes has the signature of seawater. And so it was through studying the steam of the volcanoes that people came to realize that, hey, wait a minute, that stuff that's been carried down is now showing back up. One of the things we talked about yesterday, early in the talk, was this principle of isostasy, the iceberg idea, right? When new material comes up, been melted, the water's been turned to steam, and then some of the plate melts and comes up through, it isn't that there is something that, a big molten blob that shows up 30 feet below the surface and pushes the surface up. It's just that the material comes up, it's relatively lighter, and gets added to the mass of the mountains that are there. And because of that iceberg principle we talked about yesterday, the whole thing sort of picks up a little bit. You have more mass there than you had before, it gets added to the mass. And so that's what causes the mountains to rise. It's not that this stuff shows up at the surface, otherwise you'd be having big explosions all the time. Huge explosions all the time, rather than big. So it's that buoyancy principle, it's that adding material and causing a general rise. Yes?
If you were down in that trench, what would you actually see then? Would you be able to see one plate going
in there? Rates of it are way too slow for that. What you would see in that trench is, you wouldn't see very much because there's a bunch of stuff laying on top of it. All the sediment's coming down with that trench being so deep, it gets filled in with stuff coming off the continents and stuff coming down the plate. So it's not, I mean, they're deep, they're topographically really, there's a lot of relief there. But, at the rate that this happened, I mean, you can, every time you hear about a big earthquake in Chile or Peru, you can say, okay, the plate moved. So that's every year or something like that. And these The idea that I've heard about plates moving is they move at about the rate your fingernail grows. So an inch a year, 2 inches a year, but then time 2 inches times a year times a million, 100 million years, and you can move things a long way. Do you have some? I'm running over to, and I've probably got 5 more minutes to go. Is everybody on for 5 more?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is another picture of, it's the same thing. I like it because, I mean, it's a diagram of that same picture, but it relates to the world that I've spent some time in, and therefore I like it. So this accretionary wedge is the coast of California. The outer arc high is the coast range in California. The four arc basin is the San Joaquin Valley, or what do they call that further south? There's two big valleys. San Joaquin Valley, the volcanic arc is the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Or if you're in Oregon, the accretionary wedge is the coast, the outer arc high is the coast range, the four arc basin is the Willamette Valley, and the volcanic arc is the Cascades. It explains the observed phenomena that we see. I did my undergraduate schooling at a place called Humboldt State University, which is on this accretionary wedge. It's the worst place in the world to study geology. Because this is the stuff that's on the snowplow, and it is all messed up, and it's really hard to figure out. So, if you're going to go someplace and study geology, go someplace else. It's a really good geology school, but it's really hard to do the geology there. If you're going to take a geologic vacation, go to Arizona, come back through that part of the world and drink wine in the wine country and come to Humboldt County and look at the redwoods, but the geology is really hard to do. That plus it rains a lot and there's a lot of stuff growing on top of it, so it's even worse. That's it. Just a personal point. The last thing is this bottom part talking about hot spots. If you look at the Hawaiian Islands, they're out there on their own and they have no business being there, essentially. And there are how many Hawaiian Islands? 5 or 6 or 7? They're part of a larger chain that extends for about 23 islands from the Hawaiians out through Midway, and then it kind of turns and comes up north. I don't even know how it comes on this side, I don't know it real well. The theory for that is what's called the hotspot theory. And somehow it seems as if there is a hotspot in the mantle that underlies the plate, and as the plate goes past it, every now and again it spurts out a little bit of volcanic material and generates an island. And the plate keeps going, and a couple million years later there's another pulse that comes out and it creates another island. And so now you have this chain of islands, and one of the things that you find about the Hawaiian Islands, and then as you go further out the chain, the islands get older. And the other thing is they get lower because they get washed down by the ocean. The theory for that is there is a bigger plume that comes out of the mantle and comes up through the asthenosphere. And really what the conception of that is there was a big balloon and this is the string behind the balloon. And so if you talk about as much lava as generates these islands, you're talking about 100 or 1,000 times as much lava that was in the balloon, and now we're just looking at the string. That's a lot of lava. There is a hypothesis, or there's a belief, that one of these came up in India back 275 million years ago and generated it's an unbelievable amount, 250,000 square kilometers, which I don't know what that is in miles, but it's a lot, and 350 feet deep. That's the size of the, and it's one of the big geologic features of the world. The same thing is hypothesized to have happened to create the Oregon flood basalts that, if you're from Oregon, you know about and are proud of. Mm-hmm. That hotspot is the one that's now at Yellowstone, creates the geysers there. And the reason, I guess, that we don't see these, we don't see Hawaiian Islands growing up around Yellowstone, for some reason the little string, the last remaining material, there's probably not as much of it. So, that explains all geology. Actually, the last thing is continent-continent collision, the Himalayas. This is the one part of the world where plate tectonics doesn't work very well. So my thinking is that that's the place where the next the new stuff that we're going to learn about plate tectonics is going to come from that study. India came up and hit Asia and Eurasia like a punch in the belly and pushed up mountains, and the most recent theory is it's sort of pushed a big part of China out of the way, sort of like toothpaste kind of blobbing out of the tube when you push on the tube. And that's taken up the energy and the mass of India plowing north. That's plate tectonics. I'll talk to you. If you've got any questions, talk to me whenever you see me around the village. Tomorrow is at 10:45. We're going to talk about the effects of the solid earth on the tree of life, the thing that I said we were going to talk about, the point of the series, which I told